And hello, welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Jesse Malott.
So Jesse, how many puppets were you racist to today?
Oh, geez, I'm trying to think.
You lose track, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the scene in the movie. I'm just like, I actually just drew a blank right there.
That seems like a good tease for where we're going with the review later. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pulp culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new puppet comedy noir, The Happy Time Murders. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including sex scenes and the Me Too era. Has anything changed in this end of the business, or is it just more of the same? And then more trouble with Bond 25. As we talked about briefly last week, Danny Boyle left due to creative differences, and there are competing explanations as to what those differences were. And then finally, The Big Bang Theory has only one season left in it, and we'll talk about its legacy and whether or not we should care, which should also be a spoiler about whether or not we should care. But first, when you think of female reporter characters on the big screen or the small screen, you know, what is it that we think about in terms of the common characteristics? This is where a recent article in The Atlantic went, and it had to do with Amy Adams' character in the miniseries Sharp Objects, where...
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I do. As we were talking before the show, I didn't come across the topics, but it's funny. It's funny you should bring this up as a topic because I actually did come across that article, although I think I just might have glanced at it. I think I meant to read it, but I didn't. I didn't get a chance to. But I mean, it's The Atlantic.
This is
too.
A real
it's
notch a for our professionalism too.
Well, I mean, in all due respect, I mean, it's just like I've had a lot going on.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, literally. But also, I mean, The Atlantic is a publication I respect, and Sharp Objects I really do want to see. And Amy Adams is always has been one of my favorite actresses, easily.
Oh, well, I hope this doesn't ruin it for you then, because she engages in some fairly unethical behavior in that film, or in that TV miniseries. And, you know, I think the article did a good job of laying out just, you know, how in a lot of different movies, when you're talking about even like so-called, you know, critically acclaimed movies, you know, things like Absence of Malice, Thank You for Smoking.
Fantastic movie. Thank You for Smoking.
It is a good movie, but I mean, one of the main plots is also that Katie Holmes plays a reporter who sleeps with Aaron Eckhart to get a story, which seems to be a recurring theme.
And then Aaron Eckhart throws her character on the bus.
He throws her under the bus, yeah. So it is, I mean, and then speaking of throwing people under public transit systems, the article also noted Zoe Barnes, who is the character played by Kate Mara in House of Cards. Spoiler alert for season two of House of Cards.
Yeah.
But I mean that the line that was particularly quoted in regards to the Zoe Barnes character was that she would suck, screw, and jerk anything to get a story, which is sadly, I think, like what the author of that article was getting at, that when it comes to female journalists, you know, you get you know, Woodward and Bernstein and all the president's men who are like pounding the pavement in shoe leather and like calling the White House. And then you have female reporters who are, you know.
Well, with all due respect to Woodward and Bernstein, they really are like that. I mean, they're still like that.
Woodward and Bernstein?
Yeah.
Sleeping with...
No. I mean, how they're portrayed in All the President's Men.
Right.
They really are like that in real life.
Right. No, but I think what it's getting at is the article, though, was getting at was that it paints a picture of... You see male journalists in films, they're, you know, doing the shoe leather reporting. Female reporters in films are using... You know, seduction and you know, unethical thing. And one of the even just like basic things, the article pointed out that, you know, there's scenes of Amy Adams, reporter in the series, like interviewing people and talking to witnesses, but her notebook is closed.
So yeah, that's true. Because like, I mean, I can honestly say this as a journalist, is that you're expected, if you're even recording, like tape recording or video recording, you're always, always expected to back up that, because mm-hmm. in case you lose those recordings, back it up by taking notes.
Yep, that's how I was trained. And that goes back to some, I remember when the Zodiac came out, the David Fichtner movie.
Fincher?
Yes, I got that. Of course, David Fincher. But the David Fincher movie, there was an article. I remember reading an article at the time. Like somebody wrote, like the article, the desks are too clean in the newsroom.
Oh yeah, that would actually probably be my argument to go on to. Having worked at a student paper, mind you, is that the desks were not really like clear cut and clean, because there's always like there was always paper all over the place in that place.
Yeah, it was. That was one of the things I liked. And getting back to the main thrust of the article, though, about how female reporters are portrayed, I was trying to think of like a female reporter who is, you know, it does not fall into these stereotypes. And I was like, oh, well, there's another Amy Adams reporter role, Lois Lane.
Yeah.
But Lois Lane also sleeps with us.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. All right, yeah, I think what you're trying to get at, I guess, is the long, long gender bias contained in films where like men and women do the same roles, whereas the men are far, far, far more ethical, at least in certain instances, sometimes the same positions that women occupy, like it's they're less. I guess more loose in terms of their ethics.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I think, what the article was getting at, that there's really no kind of positive portrayal of a female reporter. I mean, at least in sort of like fictional settings, because the article did cite the Showtime series, The Fourth Estate, which focused a lot on Maggie Haberman, who, whenever you see her, is always like on her phone or on, you know, talking to people or, you know, running around chasing a story. None of it has to do with...
Oh, geez. I'm actually reminded of a movie I just watched. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it would have been with Robert Redford and Kate Blanchett. And it had to do with the CBS...
About Rather.
Yeah. And the fact that Kate Blanchett's character... I'm pretty sure it's Kate Blanchett.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and the character that she played... And she's certainly seen as very, very ethical. But what she's drawn under scrutiny for is her...
Truth. It was called Truth.
Yeah. And she's drawn under scrutiny for... It's not having to do with any... It was her political biases.
Right.
Yeah. Like whether or not she was being above board about which party or potentially party she belonged to.
Right, and Maggie Haberman kind of gets slammed with that too. Whether she's like too close to, you know, the Trump organization, covering Trump for years as a local reporter in New York, and it's, I think though it's kind of like the real world, you know, where the thing that you're worried about with any journalist is what their biases are, not, you know, the nature of how you get the story. I think if we were to plot all this out on a graph in terms of reporters being undone for perceived biases or reporters being undone for extraordinary ethical behavior, you would see the cluster on the unethical side versus...
Why can't it be both?
Why can't it be both? Well, that's the... I think maybe that's the lesson of the Me Too era, but, you know, maybe not. I could be reading it wrong. Speaking of Me Too, there was an article in The Hollywood Reporter about how sex scenes or the filming of sex scenes have changed following the disclosure of Me Too, and a bizarre Harvey Weinstein connection here, because of course Harvey Weinstein was the kickoff to the Me Too age, or the exposure of Harvey Weinstein as a monstrous person. Was
nice
the,
usage word uses there by exposure.
Yeah, Freudian slip. But you know, the part of this is apparently Harvey Weinstein would keep like footage of sex scenes that was not included in the film, that this is like a new rumor about him that is...
Why is that not surprising?
Yeah, it's kind of gross, but I mean, apparently Carol was particularly referenced in this article which was about two women in the 60s in a lesbian relationship, Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett again.
Oh, right.
So,
and then, what was the one movie? It was actually a it was a very, very small movie. The creator of Wonder Woman, Dr. Marston.
Oh, right.
The Wonder Woman, yeah.
Yeah. That's I haven't had a chance to see that, but I've heard good things.
Yeah, oh, I thought it was a fantastic movie.
Oh, wow.
Incredibly well made, too.
Oh, very good. Yeah, Luke Evans is underrated.
Yeah.
He should be a bigger star, but that's neither here nor there. What I found interesting about this is that one of the things that occurred to me is, because speaking of Harvey Weinstein and his fetishization of, you know, keeping deleted sex scene footage, but it reminded me a couple of years ago of the iCloud leak of, you know, private nude photos of actresses.
Oh,
because because one of the concerns that you know, a lot of young actresses have is, you know, footage, you know, getting out. And I think,
yeah, and to all those people that have that kind of footage, it's just like, geez, store it in a safe space,
right?
Not on the internet,
right? You know, yeah, don't have the automatic link up to your iCloud. But I think one of the things that was mentioned was having fewer people on set and having less access to the footage, and it talked about gratuitous sex scenes, and it makes you think, you know, aren't most sex scenes by their nature gratuitous? But the reason it caused a correlation with me between that and the iCloud leak was because there's a kind of fetishization of, like, seeing certain actresses do a nude scene.
Mm.
And as soon as that happens and it's in that footage and it goes on, like, one of those websites like Mr. Skin or something, it then makes it sort of like that, you know, it makes the nude body of that actress sort of like particularly coveted, which then when you get the iCloud thing, those private pictures become just another sort of sex scene that's meant for public consumption, at least in the minds of the people who leak those things and share those things. So, I mean, that's just something that I thought of in sort of drawing the comparisons here too. So it's you know, there's a lot going on here than just, you know, whether or not who's on set and what reasons you do it and what pasties you wear, although I mean that's all part of it too.
Mm.
Anyway, it's interesting the timing of this too, because a couple of weeks ago Evangeline Lilly was talking about how she did a sex scene on Lost that was she did not feel entirely comfortable with. And that goes to the point, although...
Oh, right. I think I know the exact scene you're referring to. Yes. It's the one with Sawyer in the cages.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think it probably had to do with... Oh, geez. It was just the way the scene was set and the fact that it was, like, so wide open.
Right. No, and part of that, too, was addressed in the article that, you know, there are times when actresses are kind of cornered into, like, it's late at night, you know, they need this one shot, you know, the pressure's on. Although there's kind of more awareness and actresses are taking more a proactive approach in terms of laying out what they're comfortable with and what they're not comfortable with in advance. There's still pressures being levied on them that, you know, are unexpected, like what sound like what happened to Evangeline Lilly.
And yeah, and there you go, talk about like who should be a bigger star. I'm surprised I'm surprised she's not a much bigger star.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, maybe that changes with Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Mm.
She has, like, a very 60s Wasp-like haircut.
Oh, for sure.
So maybe that's, like, a long-term investment in the part. I don't know. Okay, we're going to talk about a couple of less serious things. I always say this, like, the point of this show was, because my other show is politically driven, so it's more serious topics, and the point of this show was to be less serious all the time, mm-hmm. and then Me Too happens, and it's serious all the time. For James Bond fans, this is serious, though. And we had this breaking news. Well, it wasn't really breaking news, but when we were recording end credits last week, it was breaking for Peter and I. But Danny Boyle has left James Bond 25, although it seems like the script was done and they were in the casting phase and getting ready to roll sometime this fall. Peter was not surprised that Danny Boyle left. Were you surprised that Danny Boyle left over creative differences?
Oh, geez. I mean, look at the movies that Danny Boyle does. I'm surprised that he actually signed up to do James Bond in the first place. I'm wondering, like, why he actually was asked to do it. Like, because I remember hearing when I remember hearing that he was actually going to be the director of James Bond, like, what? I mean, you're talking about the guy that did Trainspotting.
Yeah. Yeah. And
not that I don't love his Trainspotting.
Right.
I
mean, no, I
like Shallow Grave too, and Sunshine. A lot of his movies are fantastic.
Million. Yeah.
Except maybe The Beach.
The Beach has its nice scenery in The Beach. But, okay, so there were, since we talked about that very briefly last week, there have been two sort of competing narratives for this. Number one, which came out in The Telegraph, which is a UK paper, said that Boyle wanted to cast a Polish actor named Tomasz Kost as the main villain. If you don't know who Tomasz Kost is, that's okay, because I think he's mostly done just Polish things. But he was going to play the villain in what was supposedly going to be a more sort of real-world set Bond movie, where it's going to deal with the idea of the new Cold War with Russia, or like the complicated relationship with Russia and the West right now. And the new narrative which has emerged is that Barbara Broccoli, who is one of the producer, and her father was the main producer for the first, I think GoldenEye was his last movie technically, but he had been the producer on all the James Bond films before that, and she kind of took over. Her and Daniel Craig were looking for a big, spectacular, epic death for James Bond at the end of this movie, and Danny Boyle thought that was, in his words, ridiculous. And that was according to The Star, I think it was. The Sun. In the UK, not the Toronto Sun, the Sun in the UK, which is a well-known tabloid paper in the UK. So it's a competing, you know, which offense was the greater, or which was the real offense, and which was kind of like the, we're going to put out this story that Boyle wanted this obscure Polish actor as the main villain, and not that we want to kill James Bond in a big spectacular death because he's not Doctor Who. James Bond doesn't regenerate. It's
yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I'm just when you're going on about the Polish actor, I was trying to think. No. Like, I do have a point here. I was just trying to think. I'm wondering to what extent Danny Boyle actually cares about casting. That's what I was actually thinking in my head. I'm wondering if that's ever driven him to not necessarily turn down or back away from a movie, but if he is trying to push to get certain actors, and it doesn't necessarily happen. Right. And it just made me think, because I actually watched this recently, so it kind of stuck in my head, Mulholland Drive, and the one line where the one director actually played by Justin Theroux, and still one of my all-time favorite movies just because of just how Lynchian and weird it is. But it's the one line where he's told, you can cast all the actors you want, but this is the girl. And that line gets repeated throughout the movie. I'm just wondering, how many times have directors had to been forced to put in an actor that they simply can't agree with? That's what I was thinking.
It's, yeah, I'm somehow skeptical of that. The Barbara Broccoli, who's sort of the steward of a legacy now, because I guess on the one hand it would answer this, this fan theory that's been out there a long time that in each James Bond portrayer is actually a new character who, along with the 007 designation, you also get the name James Bond.
Oh yeah, no, I've actually heard that theory too, and I'm like, I don't know if I actually believe it.
You're right.
And here's the funny thing is, the reason why I don't believe it. Well, I mean, the creator himself was in MI6.
Yeah.
And I know it wasn't actually Ian Fleming himself that the character is actually based on. It was based on I don't know how close a relationship he had with the character of James Bond, but it was based on someone that he worked with in MI6.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's definitely not canon, if that's what it is. I think as much as it would be an unexpected way to end the Daniel Craig era. It's
right.
It's not, there's a reason why Logan, let's say, takes place in a potential future.
Right.
When it's Hugh Jackman's last movie, it's because Wolverine is going to die with Hugh Jackman no longer portraying him. There's been a couple of years that we're going to hear about somebody being cast as Wolverine in a new X-Men movie or something. But
and it's funny, actually, we're discussing Danny Boyle leaving James Bond because rumor, I mean, it's been going around apparently for the past like few days, if not a week, maybe two, is that Idris Elba is once again like supposedly in contention for being the next James Bond, which I think would be fantastic because he is a very colorful guy, and like even in interviews he's very colorful, and like I've always thought he's a great like character actor, and it would be nice to see him actually be the head of a franchise because I mean, like, he was in Thor, but he's like very minimally in Thor.
Yeah, he runs the Rainbow Bridge or whatever.
Yeah,
whatever it's called. it's I guess that would be the leap. It would be like the Daniel Craig Bond dies or something happens, and you know, it leaves it in muddle, and then you come back for James Bond 25, and all of a sudden it's like, we had to hide your identity, so now you're Idris Elba looking James Bond. I mean, it could be done, I suppose.
Or it's like a Doctor Who.
It could be a Doctor Who where he's, you know, his wrists glow and then the phone box is destroyed or something. I don't know. It seems too silly to be believed. And I think what the real thing is, apparently Barbara Broccoli had a problem with Danny Boyle like bringing in like all his people. Because John Hodge was writing the script and he's collaborated with Danny Boyle several times. So apparently this was like something that was extending to, you know, various aspects of production. Of course, James Bond, a well-oiled machine that uses a lot of the same behind-the-scenes talent. It all shoots at Pinewood in London. There's a dedicated James Bond stage there. So, you know, how much of this is not really about what was creatively going on in terms of the meat and potatoes of the story or who was going to be in the movie, and how much of this was about producers worried that they're losing their grip to a director.
Oh, to his supposed auteur, right?
Yeah.
No, I totally understand that too. And yeah, I guess I didn't think it from that aspect that it's like it's like the studio. It's kind of a studio system, right? And you simply like, oh, we have all the elements. We just simply put in this this puppet that we control. And you know, Danny Boyle, considering he comes with such a pedigree, he's an Oscar winner. They can't really tell him what to do. I would imagine, given the fact of his long, long story career.
Yeah, it's curious too, coming off of Sam Mendes, who is also
an Oscar winner.
As we've kind of seen in the Star Wars realm, you know, you have somebody like Rian Johnson who has, I think, auteurish tendencies.
Oh, absolutely.
Who is able to navigate in that system where somebody like Phil Lord and Chris Miller could not.
Right. Yeah. And like still looking at The Last Jedi, although like there's just certain story arcs that bother me a little. I mean, the movie is phenomenally shot.
Yeah. No, there's a lot to Last Jedi that's just beyond the story in terms of different decisions and the ways it looks at the universe. But I wouldn't have thought it possible, but Rian Johnson was able to, you know, work in the system. And
well, and like, yeah, and here's a guy who came up from indies and he had done what, three movies, Brick, Brothers Bloom, which is fantastic.
Yes, I agree.
And Looper is phenomenal as well.
Yes.
Looper is basically, at least in my opinion, Blade Runner meets Field of Dreams. But it's still fantastic. I mean,
and not just because he's killing people in a cornfield.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's interesting now to think about where, like, who can they turn to, because I mean, there's a couple of projects. There's Bond 25 now. There's Guardians 3. You know, these big projects. A lot of people have high expectations and hopes for. Like, who can you bring in? Who can you bring in for James Bond 25? Who can follow in Danny Boyle's footsteps in realizing this? Especially if it sounds strongly like Danny Boyle executing a particular vision for the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I'm also reminded, or it just reminds me of Edgar Wright and the fact that he passed on Ant-Man. Marvel, I guess at that time was already a well-oiled machine as well.
Yeah.
And and even bigger than James Bond because of how much money all of the Marvel movies have raked in.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Edgar Wright probably had a lot more ownership on Ant-Man than anyone who's ever worked on James Bond since.
Oh, I would, yeah, I would imagine Goldfinger. So.
I mean, that's a good example that Peyton Reed came in and was able to deliver something. Probably not what Edgar Wright's vision would have looked like, but something that was very enjoyable and something that managed to surf the machine between the machine and something that was artistically satisfying too. Maybe not so artistically satisfying will be the end of The Big Bang Theory, which was announced last week that it's coming to an end this coming season. So next May will be the series finale. Apparently it's because Jim Parsons did not want to make $50 million for 2 years of work to continue on with the show. Before we get into Big Bang, I just want to say, like, it's going to be a big year for series finales next year with Game of Thrones and Veep and Homeland and now Big Bang
Homeland
Theory.
Who cares?
Well, some people still like Homeland.
I mean,
I'm not one of them, but
yeah, like, I mean, I liked Homeland for the first couple of seasons and then it just kind of like fell off a cliff a bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, but how do we feel about Big Bang?
I mean, I'm just like, oh, it's over finally. Like, I mean, shows, like, believe it or not, I mean, you can't sustain a certain creative arc after a given number of seasons. Like, shows do really hit that edge. I'm very surprised, but also delighted at the fact that a show like Mad Men did last for as long as it did. Mm. And it really did end, I think, on a proper note. Mm-hmm. And same, Breaking Bad... like, really knew how to tight, like, it would seem to be a very well orchestrated run, and they ended it on like such a high note.
Yeah. Probably the best episode of the series is like the second last episode.
Yeah.
Which is very rare. So, as you sort of get into the end game, I think comedies, and it's especially true with comedies because comedies depend on like a certain beat. And a certain, repetition in terms of the gags, in terms of the jokes, in terms of the relationships. And you can only hit the same beats before you get tired of hearing hearing the song. And I think I haven't watched Friends, I think, since it was, like, on first run. But, it's one of the rare sitcoms that was able to, like, kind of reinvent itself just enough to keep it fresh, that it was able to go on for 10 years and never feel like it was trampling over itself. Mm. And Big Bang never really found that. I mean, Raj is, I don't watch the show regularly, but, from what I've seen, Raj is still like the odd man out in terms of like a steady relationship. People get upset about Apu, but it's like, how about this like poor Indian guy who's like the only one in his like peer group who can't hold on to a steady relationship?
Right. Well, I don't know if they would actually get upset about that. I mean,
yeah.
No, it's just like,
I understand Apu's a stereotype.
Whereas like the way they have Raj, I mean, I think it's just a certain like social awkwardness. And I mean, it doesn't matter that would certainly play across like any amount of like gender stereotypes for sure. Because I mean, it doesn't matter like whatever culture you're in, there's going to be a certain amount of women and guys who are just simply awkward at like talking to the opposite sex. I mean, it's always been the case.
Well, all the characters had a degree of social awkwardness. But in the beginning, and all the white guys found partners and the one brown guy doesn't. And maybe that's racist, and maybe it's not like explicitly racist, but maybe that's going to be the big finale, is that Raj will finally find someone who likes selective mutism. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I'm just... The only thing I can think of from the Big Bang Theory is just the way that John Galecki's character is on the show.
Yeah.
And I'm just, like, bringing it back because I remember... Because I've been rewatching Entourage, and it is a ridiculous, like, Hollywood-type show. It's just, like... But he plays... he basically plays himself on that show, and he plays, like, an atypical jerk, and it's just like he's the complete opposite of what his character is on the Big Bang Theory.
It just taints everything.
Yeah.
All right. We accept Johnny Galecki for his flaws. So we're going to take our musical break and then come back with our review of the week, which is the Happy Time Murders. To cue us up, here's a little ditty from Dumb, whose album Seeing Green is currently on the CFRU Top 20 chart. The fact that we're playing Dumb should not be taken as a condemnation of our review coming up, although maybe. Anyway, this is Art Fact. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Hyper sucrose. It'll put a human in a diabetic coma for a month, but to a puppet, pure ecstasy.
I'm not doing that.
Do it, mate, Zach. Take it.
Oh, sorry about your dead human friend, Phillips.
Wait for it.
Okay, that was a clip. That was a clip from The Happy Time Murders. It is the new film from Brian Henson, and it stars Melissa McCarthy, Bill Beretta, Maya Rudolph, Leslie David Baker, Joel McHale, and Elizabeth Banks. I have many questions. First of all, what are puppets in this world? Because they are both treated as like a racialized group.
Yeah. like a minority, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a scene where there's like somebody collecting like puppet feet.
Yeah.
Like scalps or like, I don't know where, but it seems like they're being like trafficked for body parts too, yeah. Like shark fins. I'm very confused by what the allegory is supposed to be.
Absolutely. I don't know how to explain this movie. Like it was a lot of fun. And it was very crude, and I guess that's really the only explanation you need. It basically just reminded me. I'm thinking I'm just like probably a guy who just like watched Ted and just like I could do this better.
It's very much like, I guess like probably the closest comparison is Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh,
except
yeah.
It's like puppets instead of tunes.
Yeah.
So it's a world, and this leads me to my second question. It's a world where puppets and humans live side by side.
Right.
But puppets are a marginalized group, and we have this one character, Phil Phillips, who's a puppet, who was on the police force.
They should have just called him Bill Phillips.
They should have. Or like the actor who played him, his real name is Bill Beretta. I mean, that's a fantastic name. That's a film noir detective name,
yeah,
right
absolutely.
There. Phil Phillips was on the police force. He was a detective, and he had an accident, let's say, where he shot a civilian when he was trying to shoot a suspect. He was accused of not wanting to shoot a puppet, and so he's drummed off the police force. No puppet can be a police officer now, so now he's a private eye, and Melissa McCarthy was his partner, and so there's someone going around killing all the members of this puppet TV show that was called the Happy Time Gang, which was one human character and several puppet characters. This leads me to my second question is, it's mentioned in the plot that the Happy Time Gang was like a breakthrough show in terms of showing like puppets and humans like living together, and it's like if this was the first successful TV show with puppets in it, what were puppets for? Because puppets were invented for like children's entertainment,
right?
And so where do puppets come from?
That's a good question, because like, yeah, in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they explain where toons come from.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, actually, that's a good question. But then again, this movie isn't a deep think piece either.
No, it's, but it, you know, it does remind me of, well, it reminds me of a couple of things, but it reminds me of Bright, the Netflix movie about the
right,
the orc cop. That's what the movie, that's what it should have been called. It should have been called Orc Cop, but that's neither here nor there. But it, you know, Lindsay Ellis, who does a lot of like video essays about film theory, she did a really great breakdown of the world building of Bright and just how it was so haphazard in terms of why orcs are an underclass and how like magical creatures are part of a shared history with humans and how that world comes about and how many plot holes there are in terms of in it. And I feel like someone making the Happy Time Murders should have watched that video essay, because you have to kind of believe the world building. You can't be sitting there thinking to yourself while watching this movie unfold. And I may be reading too much into it, I admit. But you can't be sitting there thinking, where do puppets come from? Why are they second class? Are they people or are they animals? Like, why is like Phil Phillips like the first puppet to ever try and be a cop? That seems kind of bizarre, because half the puppets you see are, well, not half the puppets, but there are a lot of puppet cops, I think, over the years.
Mm.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's not a movie to think deeply over, for sure.
That is evident. but I will say, like, the puppet craft was really good, because it's Brian Henson, who, yeah, his father was Jim Henson, so he knows his stuff. And I wish that, that, you know, there maybe been some more, I don't know, discussion or some more brainstorming about where, like, you know, I don't know what it is I was really after, because I didn't, you know, there's a sort of behind the scenes reel as the credits roll in terms of how they did the puppets and
right,
which I found eminently more fascinating than the movie itself. But I love the puppet craft in it. I love the idea. I just feel that this was like couple of guys over, you know, a brew one night, like, you know, we should do a film noir with puppets. and there's like, brilliant, let's pound out a script. And they pound out like the most pedestrian film noir script.
Oh, for sure. But in all honesty, I mean, it is a pretty crass, pretty funny movie, and like that's the one thing I actually really really appreciate it. But you're right, it was a very if it was a film noir, like I'd be like, wow, this is like D-level film noir. But maybe that's what they're going for. Maybe they're just like, let's do a ridiculously like straightforward cop movie and make it about crass puppets. I'm like, oh, sold.
I guess. And I'm really looking forward to this. But, you know, I was thinking about our review of, not our review, because you weren't here for that, but for Ready Player One.
Which I still haven't watched, and probably won't, actually.
Yeah, that's fair. But so much of that is just about, like, borrowing stuff that you recognize without, like, understanding the context of it, without trying to, you know, do something new with the material. Like, you just have Iron Giant in there, so nerds in the office go, look, it's the Iron Giant! And I feel like that's kind of what's happening here. It's like, it's a puppet, so it's funny, as opposed to something like, I'm thinking a lot about Team America World Police, which was marionettes, but it was a movie where it was like a big dumb Michael Bay action movie, but with marionettes, and it was so wholeheartedly committed to that, and all the comedy came out of that we're doing this big dumb Michael Bay movie with marionettes. And I have a feeling that somebody, the couple of scenes, saw that and thought, oh, we could do that with Muppets. but with film noir instead of with, you know, Michael Bay action movies. But I think they didn't understand that, you know, if you're going to do it right, you have to play it straight. And but I mean, you know, I feel like my grievances are well listed. So try and persuade me a little about what you liked about.
What I liked, but I guess I just liked the crass humor because I did watch the preview and I was just mm-hmm. like, wow, this is absolutely and utterly ridiculous. And I guess that's what I appreciate about it. But no, I understand your faults with it. And I don't disagree with them at all, actually. No, I just like whenever there's a criticism of a movie, it's just I do take it for what it is. And you just realize, yeah, I can see that. But it doesn't necessarily bother me. You know what I mean? It's just like why certain movies stand the test of time, why others don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are perfect explanations as to why. And whereas like this movie, it is meant simply for entertainment, and I guess it just has that kind of as I mentioned, it seems a Ted type movie.
Mm. But Ted was interesting too, because the bear, it's not a world full of sentient teddy bears. It's made explicitly clear that this was a singular event, and it's implied that Ted enjoyed some degree of celebrity for a couple of years, and before then he's working at the checkout counter at the grocery store, and I guess it's in talking about Ted, without that line, it's just kind of like Family Guy, where you just assume that a dog is at a bar and ordering martinis, and it's fine. But I feel like there was a step missing that prevented me. And it's not like I'm one of these people who's I have to understand the mechanics of every fantasy world. And I once was writing a web series with a group. And a couple of members of the writing team was stuck on this idea of a sword or of a pen that can turn into a sword and vice versa. And they were like, well, how does the mass of the sword fit into a little pen? And most of the rest of us were sitting there. It's like, it's magic. It's magic. That's all you need to know. It's magic. The sword goes into the pen because it's magic. So, I mean, I've been on both ends of this. But I wish I could have just, been able to enjoy the zaniness, because, the zaniness was substantial. I was also bothered by some other things. One of them is the criminal underuse of Elizabeth Banks in this.
Oh, right.
She's got two scenes and...
Well, I mean, don't most of the people that are... I mean, there's a lot of people in the movie. Maya Rudolph.
She was also criminally underused. But I mean, yeah. Maya Rudolph's also criminally underused in general.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But for the limited amount of time that she's in the movie, I thought she was fantastic.
Yeah, she's good. She's always funny.
Yeah. And, his name escapes me at the moment. The main star of Community.
Oh, Joel McHale.
Yeah. He was fantastic, and he was only briefly in the movie, too.
he was better here than he was on The X-Files, also in FBI Business.
maybe that's why they brought him into the movie. They're just like, hey, wait a minute. Here's a guy who's played an FBI agent before.
There was, and Leslie David Baker, who is Stanley from The Office. A lot of people remember.
Oh, right.
He played the police lieutenant.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he was very pitch perfect as the police lieutenant. They just bring him in to sort of yell at Phil Phillips and Melissa McCarthy. At set times during the film, and I thought he did very well with that role.
Yeah, he plays the stereotypical angry police officer,
angry black police captain. Yeah. it's right out of Central Casting.
But... Yeah, right. It's actually a joke from Community too.
It is a good, you're right. That was a joke from Community. Are you a Melissa McCarthy fan?
I am, actually. It's weird. I guess it depends on the movie. It's not her. It's sometimes she's in the wrong movie and utilized wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, I think she was one of the best things about the Gilmore Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I guess it just depends on the movie. I'm blanking. I'm trying to think of specific movies that I can honestly think that I really liked her. And it's just because some of the stuff she's in is just too crass. So I wouldn't necessarily watch it.
It's interesting that you admire this film for its crassness, but also admonish Melissa McCarthy's reliance on Crass in her filmography.
Well, here's why. It's just like whenever I watch like previews of the of like certain movies that she's in, it's just like, oh, I don't know if I could sit down and watch it just because of what the movie's about, and it has nothing to do with her or anybody in it. Like even I remember the one movie she did with Jason Bateman, I think it was,
right?
She steals
his identity.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, this is so idiotic.
Yeah, I mean, that was like kind of immediately after Bridesmaids, I guess, when she was right. like grasping onto whatever, you know, writing that fame. I like Melissa McCarthy a lot, but I think she's doing like Melissa McCarthy, like the routine here.
Right.
I don't think she was bad, but I don't think she was really stretching herself either.
No.
It's sad because, you know, I find her funny. I like her delivery and the sardonic sort of delivery that she brings sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the scene where they're at his brother's house, Phil Phillips' brother has been killed, and she comes out and she starts like talking smack about the puppet parts lying everywhere. It's so in bad taste, but she delivers it with such a straight face. It is that's something she's really, really good at. I feel like with a lot of people it's a lot of wasted talent here, except for the puppeteers. The puppeteers are exceptional, but the human talent is I feel somewhat wasted.
Well, what about the voice talent?
Oh no, the voices were fine.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I liked.
I mean, that sex scene in The Office. Like I couldn't stop laughing over that.
Yeah, that was. I mean, that was just over the top enough. I mean, up until the point where he ejaculate silly string for about 5 minutes.
Well, that's why. Like that was the part that I loved. The fact that they're just like, no, we're gonna stretch this out even more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which leads me to another question: why do male puppets ejaculate silly string? It's, you know, there's a series of questions like this, like why are puppets addicted to sugar?
Like, well, I guess they're just like, well, we can't put cocaine in the movie.
I guess it's the other white powder.
Yeah. But it's like, we could kind of get away with this, but we got to, you know, make so much E-rated, even though they're swearing a lot in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm not sure if they were, what they were trying to get dinged for more, the swearing or the drug use. it's, you know,
maybe that was actually cut at the last minute. It was just like, yeah, you got a lot of swearing in there, but you got to cut out the cocaine.
Yeah. and they just sort of re-edit it to just all be sugar. I don't know. It always seemed bizarre to me that, although I did laugh because there's a subplot about Melissa McCarthy having a puppet liver, which is,
right,
again, never explained, because you would think having felt inside your body would be somewhat dangerous. But Phil Phillips opens her fridge and she's got a ton of like maple syrup bottles in there. Like she's like an alky, but she drinks maple syrup. It's, I mean, there's little things like that. I like the whole thing with the brother who is like becoming a lighter shade of blue because he's bleaching his, you know, again, it plays into the racial thing it's playing at the edges at, but I'm not entirely, they didn't take it to its.
You know what? Like, maybe there's like, okay, we're going to like skate the line here very closely to the edge and like not go over it.
Maybe. And then my other question is, of my list of questions, is how are puppets incestuous?
That's.
Because there's the thing about the cousins. Yeah,
yes.
Who are married to each other. Yeah. And I really did a deep dive on this. I was like, I guess they could be technically incestuous if, like, they were both puppets made from, like, the same cloth.
Yeah.
But I don't think that was... I think they were two different colored felt puppets.
So right.
How are they incestuous? How are they cousins? I don't...
Now, that... If there's any takeaway from that movie, it's that.
It's just, like, I feel like there's some kind of academic paper to be mined from this, from all my very logical questions. But I don't know. I got nothing. But it's you know, I went into this with a lot of great expectations. So maybe it's my own fault that the movie didn't meet them, that the movie was the way it was. And I think we live in such a time where we're just like screaming for, you know, originality, that, you know, a puppet film noir comedy should fill that void. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to get the money to make the movie, then it should, you know, at least deliver. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe I'm blowing things out of proportion, so to speak.
Yeah, no, it's it's just funny. I'm wondering, like, what, like, I would love to know the people that wrote this movie, like, what exactly was their intention even just before they started writing it? Mm-hmm. Because it is always interesting to see, like, I'm just trying to think, but a lot of movies, when you can pick them apart, they always start with a specific idea and a specific intention. And I want to know to what extent, say, for instance, it's just a general question for, like, all movies and anyone who is interested in movies, is from, like, the general intention of the start and the beginning of a movie to when it's actually completed, and to what extent the creative force behind that movie actually gets the final say in what that product is.
I get the sense, because it's Brian Henson, who is, you know, he's directed several Muppet movies, mm-hmm. and he, you know, because of his last name, he's so indelibly tied to the Muppets, and that's not something he can work with. The Muppets are part of this huge media conglomerate called Disney, and then they will use the Muppets as they see fit. And I'm off my hinges, but I think for Brian Henson, this was kind of a declaration of look what I can do. Look what we can do with the technology, using the technology. And maybe this is some kind of demo reel so we can get to the next Dark Crystal or the next Labyrinth or the next The Witches, you know, something that's really going to test the shall we call it the Muppet genre. But it's
or maybe it's just like, look, I took what my dad did and I made them ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we could go back and read this as a giant FU.
Oh, man. Yeah, that would be a great way to end it. It's just like, hey, Dad, look what I did.
Because there's, in the porn shop, there's this vulture character who does kind of look like a Sam the Eagle.
Oh, right.
And I don't know. There might be something to this, that, you know, with the bunny. I know there's also a popular Muppets character who's also a rabbit. You know, the Phil Phillips looks kind of like the guy who does the newscast on Sesame Street. What's his name? Guy Smiley.
Oh, right.
You know, so it's, you know, the kissing cousins, let's call them, kind of look a bit like Bert and Ernie. They're certainly colored the same. So it's, you know, there might be something to this. There's no frog character, which I guess maybe may have been like too much of a giveaway. But it could be that. And, you know, I guess if, you know, to wrap this up, if that is sort of like himself to move away from the Henson legacy and try to, or, you know, say that, you know, I even if it's just something more benign, like, I don't take this legacy too seriously and I can have fun with it. It you know, maybe we can let that slide a little, but
right.
In the meantime, I'm just left with a whole ton of logical fallacies.
So basically you're just like trying to piece apart this movie. Just like, well, Brian Henson, like, what are you doing? Is that the final question you have with
Brian
this?
Henson, what are you doing? I think that about sums it up. That about sums it up for sure. Anyway, that's the Happy Time Murders. See it if you dare. And if you have other questions, you know, if it promotes other questions, let us know. So we do have to say goodbye for the week. Sadly, we also must say goodbye to Jesse, who is selfishly putting his career ahead of doing end credits. So, I mean, it seems to be this thing. We're at the end of summer. It happened last summer. We lost a co-host, and this summer we're end of this summer we're losing a co-host. But, you know, you haven't been on the show that long, so I just wanted to say thanks for taking part, and thanks for your contributions, and best of luck in the future.
Yeah, as I said, like, I will probably be in town, like, probably around Christmas. But yeah, like it's been a lot of great fun. I mean, I love discussing movies, as you could clearly tell. I just simply have sometimes like too much when I get into movies. Like, I do like take it seriously just because it is a passion. I mean, at one point I did want to make movies, but then I realized like, no, there's too many characters in Hollywood.
So we went into government instead, where there are no characters.
Well, actually, to take a line from Kevin Spacey, of all people.
That's a good place to leave it on, coming full circle with the YouTube stuff.
Because, he said this on the Colbert Report, and this one is when he did Who's Doing House of Cards, is that he's just like, everyone in government, you got to realize that a lot of them are just really bad stage performers. It's just all a bad act.
Well, that's a great place to leave it on.
So there you go. A tie kind of to the crass humor of Happy Time Murders.
Fair enough. If you like this episode of End Credits, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, and you can find all previous episodes of the show there as well. You can find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Jesse, if people want to follow you in far-flung places, where can they find you now?
Well, I'm on Facebook, and I'm also on Twitter at Jesse Malott.
And I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. That's Thursday, 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And between now and then, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday for more End Credits. And we will see you then.